before you know it, the hairs are up on the back of your neck, and like, this is good. And then we go, should we open a restaurant? And then you go, let's just do this. And it's not about the money. This is knowing that we're here to serve, but we're not servants. And that's been the powerful, I guess, learnings over the last 2 years. We're here to serve, but we're not servants.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. The underlying theme of many discussions we've had over the last 2 years has been that of change. Change that has occurred in people, in practices, a chance to change, and the potential within it. But as the normal day-to-day returns, what's being left behind? What is being adapted? And how do we navigate our way through a new lens? Jason Roberts is a chef by trade for the last 30 years, a very influential food communicator too. Jason, how are you?
G'day, Huckstep. Good to nice to chat to you, bud. I was actually just researching music and came across Genocide and was clearly surprised with some of the music that you were singing. Mate, gosh, you're a talented. How incredible.
Well, I think I sounded more like a coffee machine in those days when I sang like that.
I think it's magical. I think it's magical that we all have this, we find our way in the world and eventually we end up where we're meant to end up.
Well, you have many creative outlets, and one of the interesting things that's happened in more recent times is G'day Neighbour, this way of connecting. How did that come about for you, and what have you got from it?
I think, you know, we at the start of COVID, we all were looking, you know, what do we do next sort of thing, and, you know, a lot of my work was still American-based. I was actually literally the week before was meant to jump on a plane to head off to do a show in Chicago and then New York. Anyway, so that shut down, and before we knew it, everything was sort of shut down. Everyone was scrambling for toilet paper. I worked out a long time ago you could get 4 wipes out of 1 piece of paper. So I wasn't rushing, but I knew I had to change the way I looked at the world in a very short amount of time. And I think somewhat blessed growing up in a restaurant world where you sort of have to work 11th hour, last minute. My first thought was, how do I help my community? How do I? It wasn't even how I grow something. It was just, how do I be present for my community? So the first thing I did, you know, so doing this Instagram live thing called G'day Neighbour, that sort of just came and evolved. And that was through, you know, a good friendship. But ultimately it was opening my windows to those walking past and just checking in. And like, it was, hey, going, I got to know everyone. I started making handmade pasta and literally just giving handmade pasta out the window. But we all know everyone was making sourdough and banana bread, so I jumped on that bandwagon and started creating, you know, social media content around that. And then we started making content on how we lose the weight from all the banana bread and sourdough we were eating. So I was just going with the times. But G'day Neighbour, in the beginning was just a way of connecting with my community, and the way I guess how it served me now, it's given me a community of people who check in on me. It's very self-serving. It's a very special little place, and I hold it dearly. And I think more importantly, it's the kids who stay curious and knock on the window and ask questions and share little moments, getting to know them, getting to know their parents. But we have this incredible village vibe.
Has this changed the way that you cook during this time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it was interesting because over the weekend we had a taste of Coogee at the Entertainment Quarter, and there was myself, there was Tommy Walton, Colin Fastidge, Rory Dillon, but a few of us, and we had all changed. I could see how we'd put less pressure on who we were. There was less ego in what we were putting out. We cared less about the expensive ingredients. We cared more about how do we stretch the budget, how do we have less wastage. But I think that's a common thread through all communities and through the world now, is how do we consume less? The stories of regeneration and regenerating the land. Like, there's all these underlying stories that need to come to fruition, and how do we spread that message? So I think our cooking has adjusted right across the board.
You mentioned that a lot of your work is in the US. So what sort of impact has that separation had on you?
To be honest, it's been quite positive. But because I would say that, you know, I cast my net pretty far back in 2005. I'd started doing television in 2000 with Channel 9. went to Channel 10, then, you know, got a bit of a foot in the door in the States with a couple of the networks. And I ended up moving to America in 2006. So I had a storage facility here. I moved to the States. I had a storage facility in LA, and then ultimately come back to Sydney, then back to New York. So I was like, I cast that net so far with the amount of travel, the communities, like these little sub communities around the world through storage facilities and friendships. But ultimately COVID had sort of obviously reeled everyone back in. We were quite confined, but I realized the importance of having a base. I hadn't really had that. You know, I left home at 18. I was living in New Zealand and moved countries. I wanted to get into cooking. I mean, I always wanted to cook and found my feet. But I never really had a base, and COVID sort of forced the hand a little bit, and it was time to create some solid foundation. And it's been very good for me. I think it was a great way to manage mental health. I think when you feel a little displaced, as soon as you have a little bit of a community, someone, you know, it could be just a neighbor who checks in on you or who doesn't necessarily know your past or care less about who you are, but more about being present. I mean, it's been quite a magical space for me, and I've utilized it to my advantage.
You've spent many years as a professional chef and have evolved your career, but take us back to when you were young. When did you first start getting interested in food?
Yeah. I sort of grew up in a family of food professionals, you know, like everyone, you know, mum cooked, but my grandparents on both sides were either in catering or hospitality. My grandmother on my mother's side ran the catering at a girls' school in the South Island of New Zealand at Waitaki Girls. And I just remember at a very early age, and it's, you know, it's quite uncanny, you know, to think at 4 and 5 is like, oh my God, that's what I want to do. Because I just remember the smiles and the laughter and the happiness. Ultimately, you're the little kid that's being carted around and then the women offering you lollies and biscuits in a kitchen sort of thing just to get you to smile. So it's a seed that was planted, and I just seemed to have stuck with me. I grew up, ultimately ended up growing up in Queensland anyway for the best part of my earlier childhood from the age of, say, three through to 13. And it was quite a heavy time in my life. There was a lot of domestic violence and associated, you know, to my mom, and there was abuse on all levels. But so you tend to block a lot of that out, and there's one good seed that was planted, and it was just it's a memory for you. And so my go-to was like, oh my God, I want to be a cook. So despite, you know, small amounts of trauma in my earlier childhood, that little seed was planted, and whatever I could do, whether it was on a primary school level or high school, I would do home economics. I would take opportunities to cook a meal. I could growing my own garden. I didn't make the association as a kid, like if I grow tomatoes and watermelons, that would come into my thought pattern when it came to cooking. None of that, like that didn't come till later, but I just realized that all those things and growing up on a farm and sort of utilizing a whole animal when it was, you know, butchered, like all those things sort of added to my life. And there is this full circle moment in your life is like, oh, wow. So that, oh, wow. It's quite spiritual, to be honest. But I was lucky, all those seeds, and for whatever was going on in my world, like all these little seeds were planted, and they just ultimately they've come to fruition, and I feel like I've become a better storyteller because of them.
How did cooking back then make you feel?
I was limitless. I think like any young chef, and it's interesting because I've only just met someone who's 14, and I'm just like, oh my God, that was me. And he well advanced because of television. This kid is just beyond, like, his energy and passion. But I think for me, there was this, you know, like any kid who's like unsure of what they want to do when they leave. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I had to leave the country. When I left school, I got at 18, I'd still look like a 12-year-old. I was little, and like I would go for job interviews like, oh, we don't really have anything for your size. And I didn't flourish. I didn't sort of grow into my body till I was 21. But anyway, ultimately I ended up in Sydney. I started working at Ravisi's in Bondi Beach and was offered an apprenticeship. This was when Max's Shoe Store was underneath and Megan Brown was the head chef. And then ultimately went on to Armstrong's and then to Bistro Moncur in 93, I think like a year after it opened.
Take us into that first times that you're in commercial kitchens. What did it feel like? Do you have any stories of the early days?
Loved it. Oh my God. I loved it. I remember, you know, you're making, gosh, you know, a couple hundred bucks a week sort of thing. So microwaving bread rolls and pouring butterscotch sauce on it and eating it with ice cream, and seeing people pass around a plate with drugs on it was like, gross. Like, I didn't touch drugs. I managed to veer away from drugs. I didn't drink alcohol till I was 30, but I was immersed into this culture of like, oh my God. Oh, and this is my favorite story. You know, coming from New Zealand and quite sheltered, there was a guy that worked on the floor. He had long hair, and I'm like, that guy's gay for sure. He's got to be gay. Look, he's long hair. So I was a bit curious about him. And anyway, all these other guys were big, buff, muscly looking. These guys are awesome. And they were, Jason, how far can you put that banana down your throat? Oh, this far. Or they'd be, you know, but ultimately I worked out the guy with the long hair was the only straight one, and actually gay men in Sydney were big and butch and buff. So that was my foray into Sydney and the hospitality scene. I think everyone was gay and everyone loved a good time and a party. And so I loved the energy associated with hospitality. It wasn't necessarily the late nights, but it was the community and the family and having Megan Brown as the head chef, you know, at 18, you know, she would check in on me, and I didn't quite understand. You're not my parent, but you sort of care for me. It's like quite strange. Like, can't I just do what I want to do? And like, so if I'd come in and I would be pulling a face because my eyes were sore from being out late at night and dancing at the Bondi Hotel, she'd be like, you know, you need some more sleep. And I'm like, oh, that's a thing. You can tell me that. Okay, then. So I listened. So I think there was a huge amount of respect. So leaving country, not really having parents to sort of navigate your way through things and not really having a credit card. Like, I learned from people around me. So the people I worked with, my new flatmate who was also in hospitality, like, I just learned so much from the age of, you know, 18 through to 21. I mean, ultimately at 23, I was head chef at Bistro Moncur. So there was just, I just did what I could to learn more and more and more.
Take us into that kitchen. Bistro Moncur was one of the most influential in Sydney of its era. Mm. What was it like in that kitchen and being in that role so young?
Yeah, what was really special about Moncur was, I think, it was all new for me. I had spent, I'd left Ravisi's after a year and a half doing apprenticeship. The second chef had gone on to do Armstrong's in Manly, so I went with Steve Nichols. Steve Nichols stayed there for a year, and then he moved on. And then I was like, oh, what? Oh, well, I know this guy, Bill Deverell, who's working at Bistro Moncur. I've heard a few things about it. My mate Chris has worked there for a little bit as well. It's back in the eastern suburbs again. Why don't I just walk in? And coincidentally, Colin Holt was running it at the time as head chef. And someone had just literally either been sacked or walked out that day or hadn't worked out. And when can you start? And so, 2 weeks. We'll see you in 2 weeks. So literally, I remember where I sat. I remember the conversation. I remember being as nervous as all hell. I was like, I was into surfing. I was like, oh, I really want this job, but I could go surfing. But no, I'll do the job instead. So I took on that role as at the end of my second year apprenticeship. But I just, everything was new. A brondot of salt cod. I was like, what's salt cod? A rillette of rabbit. What's a rillette? Like, everything was new. There was all this new terminology. It was things that we weren't even learning at TAFE. I was like, wow, this is really special. And then we'd make sausages, or then we'd make this Café de Paris butter that had 24 ingredients. I'm like, this is ridiculous, but I love it. And the restaurant's busy. And Damien Pignola, he's like this, everyone talks to him and has this respect for him. Like, there was just this culture that existed at, you know, 11 o'clock in the morning, we'd sit down and have breakfast. But so that family environment just got thicker, and there was more care and there was more love. There was, you know, the picking through chervil at 1 o'clock in the morning because it had started to turn yellow. I was like, this sounds like a shit idea, but I love it. You know, I couldn't get enough of it. It was slowly sort of turning like moss on my skin. You know, this, I just was becoming it. And hence why, you know, those opportunities as they opened up to go from obviously finishing out my apprenticeship to pastry chef, to a sous chef, to the head chef. Like, it happened very, very quickly. And there was a very small turnover in that restaurant. And like, I can't even, you know, it blows my mind that I managed to move up through it so quickly. But I remember when the opportunity was presented to me to would I be interested in being the head chef? It wasn't even a thought. It was like, yes, why didn't I get this earlier? You know, and so I look back and think, 23 to be holding two hats. It was a huge responsibility, but I will tell you this, I was very lucky to have Damien Pignolet holding my hand the entire way through it, to the point though where Damien understood the importance of mentorship, but didn't want me to put him on a pedestal, but wanted me to surpass his knowledge too. So he would put me in front of other opportunities and share space with me when he would do his cooking classes, or when he was doing his cookbooks, he would love for me to put a recipe in it. Like, there was always these opportunities where I felt like I was part of something, not someone's tool. It's been a very special time for me.
Do you have any stories of that time with Damien that speak of that connection that you had?
Yeah, look, many. Damien was and is such a carer and such a giver, knowing his background. You know, just stories of going to do wine dinners, like Wyndham Estate, for example, and, you know, we're driving in his Saab and we're listening to Buena Vista Social Club, and it wasn't about the food, it was about the connection. So we would, you know, Damien and I still tell stories of, you know, doing a dinner for 250 people, and, you know, he remembers my being up to my elbows mixing a rice, you know, this creamed rice in a big brat pan, and a custard forming around it, and braising rhubarb, and being up, you know, sorting through. You know, you always talk about the things that were going wrong, but how it just became this magical night, and it was about the music. Like, you can bring all these elements into one thing, and it automatically just transports you back to such a wonderful nostalgic moment.
That period of time created a lot of opportunities, and you started doing things on television. How did that all begin?
It was interesting, Huck, because, you know, television was never on my radar. But, you know, back in 2000, I think it was when Jamie Oliver really hit the scene here with The Naked Chef. And I know at the time Channel 9 was looking, I was getting a lot of notoriety, as was, you know, Darren Simpson, Ashley Hughes from Alio. There was a lot of young chefs, and there were particular pieces in the paper, and, you know, I was getting invites to this, that, and the next thing. It was like, you're sort of becoming like a little bit of a rock star without having to sing. It was quite cool. So I can go here and there. I can still do my hours. You're getting some recognition. You know, Mum loved when, you know, you'd send her a little clip from the paper. I actually had to mail that. We couldn't sort of snap a shot and email it to her. I had to actually send the bloody thing. And so you just felt this energy. And like the industry, I went from step to step to step. And I just kept up with that momentum. So the TV thing presented itself because Channel 9 had been looking for someone for 10 months. There was a piece in the paper. The heading was Young Gun Celebrity Chefs Cook Up a Storm. I still have that clip of myself and Darren Simpson, Ashley Hughes. And we all did a piece to camera. The interesting thing was that Darren and Ashley had both worked at the River Cafe, where Jamie had worked at as well. But ultimately I ended up with that gig. Coincidentally, you know, because of the English, their accents, I was in front of a camera. It was terrible. You know, it took me, I was lucky. I did 4 years and sort of slid under the radar. The first two or three years just was horrible. You know, I could try to get words out, and I'd say button and all the time and okay. And I'd have to redo things. Channel 9 were very patient with me, very, very patient with me. But ultimately I think that transition, so from 2000 to 2002, I worked 7 days a week. And ultimately Damien said to me, he said, look, you're going to have to make a choice. You're going to burn out. So I decided, you know, it was hard. I'd been at Moncur, I think, close to 9 years. And I just said, look, I see the opportunity with the television at the moment. He didn't try and hold me back. He said, look, you need to go with where your heart is, and we will always remain friends. And we have, and I've done other work with him. So I just went with my heart, and I just felt there was a way of being in front of people. I didn't know what my message was at the time. Like, it starts, I feel now it's more important than what it was then, but it was like, I feel like this is something, for some reason I'm meant to be in this space, you know. And people were very critical at the time. I remember getting written off a few times. God, that shirt's horrible. Oh, what are you using that knife for? I mean, everyone's a bloody critic running television. But I think ultimately, You learned to navigate your way through the noise, and you saw everything as an opportunity. At the end of the day, I saw it as a bloody paycheck too. You know, I would head up to Rockhampton for Beef Week, or I'd head down to Victoria for something, or over to Perth for the show where you're on stage. I love that connection. It was the thing that was missed in a restaurant when you're back of house, is that, well, you cook all day and you talk to your suppliers and you work with your staff, but you don't really get to see the customers. I felt like working on television and doing those little events outside, it was like, this was my way to chat with customers. It was really important for me. I think that sort of opened a huge doorway.
In the US, you did a lot of media. How did that start for you? And what were some of the interesting sort of media experiences that you've had?
The US was very interesting. I managed to land a manager, you know, at the time who had the gift of the gab and somehow got me on Good Morning America. And once you've done Good Morning America, it's like, well, that's sort of like your baptism of fire, I guess. You do that and you do whatever you want after that. Well, you've done Good Morning America, so we know it's live television, you can hold your own. And so, you know, I had that piece. I got sent around to Sharon Osbourne and Wayne Brady and the E! Network, and ultimately ended up doing all those shows. To the point, though, where I picked up, you know, this is when brand started sort of coming out, and so we see the opportunity as a chef fronting our brand. So I ended up being a global ambassador for Amway, which is a multi-level marketing company, for literally 5 years. I traveled the world a number of times doing live shows. This what's funny is that being a multi-level marketing company, and this is before social media, you'd never know that, you know, but the biggest show I ever did was in front of 160,000 people in China. We had like close to 500 security guards. You get on stage and there's pyrotechnics and dancers and drummers. And like, I'm just cooking a piece of fish in broth with some white peppercorns. Jason Roberts, everybody. And there's 160,000 people screaming. Like, it's, I can't even tell you. I really was immersed in this like rock star lifestyle, traveling the world, not really leaving your hotel because you're exhausted. You go in for a sound check and camera check, and it was bizarre. Like, to the point I would, for now, is it's literally like 14 years ago that I was traveling on that sort of level, but it's like, it's such a blur, and I feel like I went to all these countries, but I didn't really visit them.
For someone that built a career in the industry and then became a communicator in it, what's it felt like for you in regards to your role? Like, how do you approach that communication of food?
I think that the really important thing is, and probably maybe over the last 6 or 7 years, even well prior to COVID, but I think after having coming back from, I was living in New York and working on the ABC on a show, coming back this for a second time, so I lived in LA and I came back, and I think MasterChef had sort of, you know, was really up and running, and the chefs who were coming through that were getting all these opportunities. So, and I picked up a gig back in the States. I came back from there sort of almost like with my tail between my legs, like I'd done it. You know, I landed a relationship back here. So I came back to the relationship and sort of, you know, I lead with my heart. So now the relationship is probably the right thing to put my energy into. Anyways, and so then as far as any of the opportunities, I felt like I was coming back to, oh, shit. Doesn't matter that you've been in the States and you've done shows and what you've done. It's like, I feel a bit unseen. I feel a bit useless here. So you got to start again. Like, you really have to build again. So to be honest, COVID did me a favor. Like, it gave me a chance to build something. But ultimately, you know, I think I spend a lot of time just, you know, in the morning, and I'm not very good at meditating. I'm sort of all over the place. But, you know, I'll have these thoughts and I just – like, we grew up in a world that's told you what to do. Like, our parents told us what to do all the time. There really was the only one way to do things. Schooling did the same thing. Job description sort of mandated you do what you're told. But we sort of forgot to stay curious. So now I'm at this point where I question bloody everything. You know, we had this chat the other day with the guys from Oroking Salmon and, you know, what's going to happen to hospitality sort of thing. It's like, we just need to question everything. And I've been so lucky for the people that I have had conversations with, the countries that I've had traveled to. It can mean this place of curiosity, and we will get through this. Like, the, you know, this is what's going on with COVID and with the lack of jobs at the moment, we just need to rethink. But because we're set in our ways a little bit because of what I was, you know, talking about parenting and schooling and job description. There's only one way to do this. We forget to be open to new things. We forget to be curious. So I'm sort of excited for our future. I've shared with many people, like, you know, even an event I did over the weekend where it was so quiet, but no people weren't going out in the rain and schools are closing down still with you know, COVID cases. I just keep saying to people, we have to dig the next year into the ground and we will all walk out of this together. We have to band together. It's the only way we do it. But that's how a community works. Everyone works in, everyone has a job description, whether that it's a description or not, but they have a thing that they do.
You mentioned a bit earlier that feeling as a young chef of being limitless. With your sort of extensive experience in the industry and looking in from the outside, given what's happened in the last year and a half, how do you see things moving forward and change, and what are the opportunities?
I think on an individual level and the circles of people that I'm within, I feel like probably the biggest conversation I have is like, how do I reinvent myself? How do I move forward? Okay, so for 30 years I've cooked and, you know, I've been part of restaurants and I've done television. Okay, so maybe the money's gone from that and the opportunities aren't as great. So how do I reinvent myself? First and foremost, you have to break the mold of thinking that that's what you are, that you're just a chef or you're just a TV chef. And I had this conversation with Manu Fidel just recently and he sort of broke down and just said, I don't know what I'm meant to be doing, because I was cooking and then I did the TV and then the TV disappeared and the cooking. I'm like, well, what am I meant to be doing? But it's a conversation I have with many chefs. It's because we've given so much time and love and energy to an industry that ultimately when COVID happened, it was taken from underneath of us. And then with the shortage of staff, it's like, oh, now I've got to really rethink this. I'm stretched as it is. I was the executive chef. It's like, oh, that's right. When I'm the executive chef, I don't cook as much. I'm probably more HR. I'm probably more figuring out other people's problems than cooking. So most people don't, or I feel like a lot of the chefs that I know, like, I forgot that point where I was really enjoying cooking because I didn't have the responsibilities and the ownership and the delegation. I loved when I could just turn up to work and do my thing. So the big conversation I have with people, it really is based on letting go of thinking that you are something already. Why couldn't you just be perpetually evolving and growing into something new? But it's on a creative level. And so for me, and it was interesting, I was doing a little bit of background work on your butt and the music. It wouldn't matter what you were singing. It's that you sing. But people don't go, oh, you're the singer. You're only as good as the last thing you put out into the world. I mean, that's what, you know, that's the saying. But I really believe that we're as good as what we want people to think we are. So we do what we should just do what makes us feel right. Like life doesn't, unfortunately, as we get older, I'm just sick of hearing people dying around me, to be honest, whether it be family members or friends. Like it's just, life gets tough. And the thing, as soon as you can let go of thinking that you're meant to be someone or something and you just start evolving, I cannot tell you pottery has changed my world. The amount of metaphors when you pick up a lump of mud that we don't own that comes from the earth, we probably paid for it, but and we throw it on a wheel and we bring it into something and we make a pot, you know, if it takes a little time to get centered doing it, but you can stretch it and stretch it and bring that the lip of that bowl all the way as far as you can possibly bring it, but at some point if you don't stop, it'll break or it'll collapse. And then as soon as you let go of shit, I just destroyed it, as soon as you let go and realize it's just mud anyway, make another one. In fact, I learned so much doing that that I won't go as far next time. In fact, this one may even be better. So there are so many metaphors just in that mud. It was a way for me to sort of center myself as a way of creating purpose. But ultimately, when that piece of mud or green clay goes through the kiln for the second time and gets vitrified and comes out as something solid that may last, you know, twice as long as my carcass does, it's like, wow, This is living on a primal level. This is something that I could hand on to someone. It didn't cost me anything but my time. So I think, you know, on a bit of a whimsical way, in a way of sort of engaging my inner child, mud sort of saved my thoughts and allowed me to evolve and connect on a deeper level, not just with people around me, but myself. I realized, you know, and going back to my growing up and probably growing up in a situation with a lot of domestic violence and alcoholism, and there was traumas associated to that. And we talk about kids sort of are really defined in their first, you know, 0 to 7 or 0 to 10 years where their understanding of love and unconditional love and trust comes from. At some point, if if you're facing trauma, whether it's, you know, through abuse or domestic violence, it's like something happens and you have to grow up in the world very quickly. So things just become very realistic all of a sudden. It's like you let go of that inner child, but there still is that ability to re-engage that inner child. And then, fuck, life's amazing again. It's like you start letting go of all the little things that niggle at you. You let go of the anxieties. You let go of, you just let go. And that, and that's what allows us to speak of these vulnerable moments. Men in general don't talk about it. I've healed so much in the last 2 years talking about my shit because of it. Fundamentally, it's because I picked up a lump of clay and there was just automatic association with going, did you know? It's been a full circle moment. I look at my, you know, I can look in the mirror now at 47, like, shit, I've aged a bit, but I've come a long way in 2 years, I can tell you that.
You've experienced the anxiety and pressures of stars and hats and being scored as a chef, and that sort of world got disrupted in the last year and a half. How do you see the place and the role of that in the hospitality era that's moving forward?
Yeah, this is a good, very good question. First and foremost, we've got to look on a ground level what food and hospitality is. It's providing meals. It's a way of, you know, connection, feeding those who need to be fed. So somewhere along the way, we took it upon us to, I don't know, get creative all of a sudden. And like, then through creation, and then there's competition, and there's like, now we're getting rated for it. So now we need to step up. It was good because what it did was it created opportunity for young chefs to invest more time and get a little more creative. And then it created some awareness for restaurants. But I think ultimately moving forward, and this is not forever, but this is for now because of the lack of staff and hospitality people, I think we need to remove that stigma associated to restaurants. I think we need to remove the chasing of hats and ego and being this wasteful, to be honest. I think we just need to pour our time and our knowledge into young people, pour our time and knowledge into people who feel a little bit broken by the industry, weighing in on tipping the scales for people whose mental health has been affected. And there's a re-education process. There's a lifting and lifting up process where we can encourage those who are so broken. We need to rethink wages. We need to stop the wage wars. But look, they're all big, great ideas. But if we can't do it together as a community and agree on it, then it'll fall by the wayside. I feel a little bit broken for my friends who are still, you know, they're putting all their heart and soul into a big ass menu on, and they're just not getting the numbers through. And so I can only feel that there's got to be some sort of food wastage, not to mention their mental health. They're not getting time with their family. Ultimately, I think, well, I'll just keep doing the hours and eventually I'll get some staff. But I just don't think eventually the staff are going to come, not yet, till we make these changes and make it more inviting for people to want to be back in hospitality.
This growth and change that you've experienced in the last 2 years, has that ever made you think about opening a restaurant?
I tell you what really turns me on about food at the moment, and it's my time with Tommy Walton and a good friend of mine of Arez. And to be honest, it's a little bit underground. It's opening up my windows and having my neighbors drop by and grab a taco. It's not, you're not playing by the book. It's one dish served well. It's a community of even having suppliers who've jumped on board to support different non-for-profits that we've supported with the Oz Harvest or Black Dog Institute. And even that, you know what? I want to refine that a little bit more and do something a little bit more community associated. And I know here in Bondi, there's a particular non-for-profit which sort of helps out kids who've been affected by domestic violence where the parents have separated and they've sort of been sort of left to manage their own life. So I just think, when it can't, but however, having said that, sure, a fancy new restaurant will open up and go, what if I just did that? And then I quickly go, what if I can't find any staff and I'm working every bloody hour? I think that's the real tough bit. I romanticize. I really do huck about jumping back into the restaurant. There is this energy associated when we do these taco nights. We have a line of people up, and you know, in a residential area, and Tom and I are slinging out tacos faster than the orders, are, you know, just as fast as the orders are coming in, sort of thing. It's like, oh, it's a machine. I love this machine. In fact, it reminds me of Bistro Moncur on a footy night down the road, and people lining up at 5:45. So we'd cook, you know, quickly seal off 20 steaks, and we'd have you know, confit duck sort of browned on one side. Like we were set. So Tom and I are set, and it's like, okay, windows open, let's go. And it's like, before you know it, the hairs are up on the back of your neck, and like, shit, this is good. And then we go, should we open a restaurant? And then you go, oh, let's just do this. And it's not about the money. None of this is about money. This is knowing that we're here to serve, but we're not servants. And that's been the powerful, I guess, learnings over the last 2 years. We're here to serve, but we're not servants.
What do you love about what you do?
I love that it's different every day. It can be just as tiring. Like I would consider myself a digital warrior. So everything's based around social media. I work with different brands. What I do love is the brands that I get to work with. I mean, they've been very organic in the sense of the way that we've come into partnership. It's not like a whole lot of agents and managers going to, hey, you should work with this product. And this is what they're going to pay you. It's like you start off on a smaller fee with these people, and you organically work it into your socials. And before you know it, it just becomes part of who you are. So it's not forced. It's not, you're giving a brand an identity, which ultimately just becomes a little bit of who you are. So I just love, everything just seems a little bit more organic at the moment. But I've learned a lot of lessons, you know, since starting television back in 2000. You know, I worked with a lot of people. I have a lot of great connections. And I think those connections have really come to fruition as well, because I remember, as I was saying before, you know, I cast my net too far, and I was traveling the world, and I was here, and there's a storage facility here, and there's one over there. And I was like, fuck, where am I meant to be? And then so that was it, you know, in that second week of March, whenever we went into lockdown, I was like, shit, that was that week. I had to really start rethinking everything without purposely or mind mapping what my next 2 years was going to look like. And did I think I was going to be where I am now? I had no idea. I was just happy to get through each week, you know, but I just knew that I had to make connections with people and reconnect with those I'd connected with a long time ago, because everyone's sort of come back into my life, and even the work's picked up again back in the States. You know, I've about to sign off on a contract to get me through next year. And it's just shape-shifted. I didn't have to travel the world or create content. There might be some events throughout the year that I end up at, but everything's sort of slowly coming back.
You experienced burnout as a young chef when you were highly successful. What sort of wisdom could you pass on now to young chefs with the insights that you have and experience?
There's probably a couple. I remember when put yourself, okay, the first and foremost, put yourself first. Take that first breath for yourself in the morning, you know, when you're putting your shoes on, sort of thing. I still remember walking down Queen Street in the morning and taking a big breath going, best day of my life. And I was working 70 and 80 hours a week. And on my day off, I would go and work at another restaurant because I wanted to learn Thai food. And I was so impressed by the guys at Long Grain and Sailor's Thai. I was like, at some point I want to do Thai food. I managed, because I wasn't drinking. Just I think probably one of the biggest things is stay on track, be mindful of those late nights, don't get tied up in drugs and alcohol. Those things will never serve you. Do what serves you. Educate yourself, whether you read books or Google something online, but just stay curious, question everything. I think our teachers and our mentors there are meant to guide us, but they don't have all the answers, and at some point you'll surpass them. But just put yourself first, and by putting yourself first, that's eating well, that's exercising, that's drinking plenty of water, that will serve you. And then later in life, you know, your thoughts and your wisdom, those things will just come to you. But I remember a piece that came out in the, you know, it was like the Television Guide or something like that. And I remember I just started with Channel 9, and one of the questions was, why do you like cooking so much, or what is it, you know? Yeah, it was something to do with long lines. Why do you cook? And I've always been quite quite in touch with my emotions. And you know, this is going back 20 years ago. And I just said, I do it because I want to be loved. I can tell you the flack I got from my kitchen mate. You want to be loved? What? What's that? And I look back now because I still have that article. I go, I'm so glad I said that. I stuck to my guns because it's true. I love that connection. And that's what it is. True love to me is that feeling that you have in your heart. It's not about someone else. It's how you feel. Everything else is just a connection. So stick to with what you believe in, because at some point you're going to look back and go, I'm glad I stuck with that. I'm glad that's who I was then. And, you know, when you're younger and everyone's looking for themselves and very easy to point a finger and make a statement and a comment. But I look back at that one thing and I go, I'm glad I said that now. At the time, I was like, oh, God, I wish I had said something else. It's because I like the chicks or something. But no, I'm glad I said it. I do it because I want to be loved. And I think, to be honest, I think that's that connection and being that emotional person really helped build my relationship with other restaurateurs. It thickened my relationship with Damien as a mentor, and just everything opened up, I think, because of the honesty I had for the industry.
Well, Jason, you're an inspiration, and I know there's so much more we can talk about. We're absolutely honored to have you on Deep in the Weeds today to hear your story. Please keep in touch, and we'll catch up again soon.
Sounds like a plan. Cheers, buddy.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen.
Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au.
Stay safe and be well.